Hello and welcome to another episode of Conduit Conversations for 2022, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. My guest today is Juliet Kingsman, who has been a journalist and broadcaster for more than 25 years, working in travel for two decades. Juliet was the founding editor of Mr. and Mrs. Smith, most recently the first ever sustainability editor for Condé Nast Traveler, and is author of The Green Edit, Travel Easy Tips for the Eco-Friendly Traveler. Her nonprofit consultancy, Boutico, works with award-winning brands to help them stand for something and stand out for it through their storytelling. Welcome, Juliet.
Thank you so much.
So we're going to have a conversation about sustainable travel and sustainable tourism today. And I want to start by setting out the problem statements. So why do we care? What is it that we're trying to address? What's the problem?
I have been so looking forward to talking to you about this, I have to say, because usually we have to start off by even like explaining what sustainability is, but I love that you have thrown that straight at me. There are a lot of challenges in this world, and obviously people perceive potentially that travel could exacerbate that, you know, just like almost every sector, it certainly has its extractive qualities. But it's a really, really wonderful way to, well, connect human beings, see different places. I mean, the whole, when you think of the anthropological, the sociological, there's so much that comes from us traveling. That's great.
We're going to go through all the virtues that come with travel, and there are many, and I agree. But if we're concerned about what is bad about tourism that's unsustainable or travel that's unsustainable, like, what is, you know, describe the problem.
Yeah.
How big is it? What are we trying to address?
You know, I think it's going to be the same as in anything that we look at. It's all about people seeking comfort in the quickest, cheapest, easiest way. And that's certainly the case with travel. You know, they want to, we think that happiness comes from stuff and things. And I would say in terms of travel, people I've looked at hotels, they look at the facilities, they look at the amenities, they look at excess and indulgence as being a plus. But we realize actually what we need to address is that we should be finding ways to enrich our time by human connections, by experiences. And so I think that could be applied to every part of our life, every aspect.
And so if you were to reimagine a world that is a more sustainable approach to travel from the current modes of it, what would that begin to look like? How, if you could architect that or legislate it or find a set of economic incentives to accelerate movement towards it, what would that world look like?
Great. Well, I mean, first of all, I always encourage people to be less about being consumers, more about being experientialists. And from, you know, as we know, you know, in terms of sustainability, we have to look at it in terms of social impact and environmental impact, but also economic. So I would just urge people, just again, you know, it applies to everything. When you're booking a trip or when you're going away, you want to make sure that you're spending money on local businesses. You want to make sure, you want to stem the leakage. So it's even more important, as we know, when traveling from a country that does have money and those that have money and, you know, the global north and to places which don't have money or perhaps completely rely on tourism, particularly post-pandemic. I'll quote a stat that we always hear a lot in the travel industry, obviously, which is from the UN, which is typically for every $100 spent on travel, only $5 stays in that destination that you're spending it in. Wow, right? So that could be said of everything. I think we want to support and encourage community economics.
Okay. That to me is a radical statistic, to say that 5% of money spent on travel stays in the destination to which you are traveling.
Absolutely.
That calls for an overhaul in how those economics are allocated, because that stat makes me think that the industry is essentially extractive. We go to places for pleasure. They grant us these wonderful experiences, and the power and the money and the economics reside where we currently are and not given to the people who give us the experiences.
So I am tingling with excitement to have this conversation, because it doesn't get, it doesn't happen enough. I've actually just, you know, I'm going to just be honest. I just had a really lovely get together with James Thornton, who's CEO of Intrepid Travel. They're headquartered in Australia. They're the world's largest B Corp travel company. And he said, Juliet, which hotels do you recommend? Which hotels do you love here? And every time he asked me a question about a hotel, I would shock him because I would know who the owner is. And people don't think about ownership. So you're exactly right. So if you say to me, oh, I'm going to go, well, you're not going to say I'm going to go to the Maldives, but a lot of people do. I would like to go to the Maldives and I'd like to stay in this hotel. And they give an example and I look at them and I say, right, okay, well, that asset is owned by someone in the Middle East. So that's the hardware, that's the real estate. And that management company for that hotel is an American management company. So that's siphoned off in the other direction. So people need to look at ownership. So when James asked me, oh, where should I go and stay? And I'm sorry out there if I'm going to shame a hotel that you all know and love very well. He said, how about, and I knew which one he was going to say, how about the Pig? The Pig, we all love the Pig hotels, don't we? In it's all about kitchen gardens and eating locally in New Hampshire, where we all getting that country house, warm, fuzzy feeling. Well, it is owned by the biggest manufacturer of single-use plastic in Europe. Big shout out to Jim Ratcliffe, petrochemical engineer. So, you know, we need to look at who we're giving our money to. And you say about distribution of wealth, that's a really big part of it. I always love to say to people, oh, Four Seasons. I was born in Canada, so proud of the Four Seasons. Of course, the founder was a great person. But now do you know who owns the Four Seasons?
No idea.
Bill Gates and a Saudi Arabian prince. I've forgotten his name. Yeah, warming the cockles, want to book in to check, spend your money at the Four Seasons. See, so it's very, very interesting. It slightly explains why that money is not staying in local destinations.
So the policy or the behavioural corollary of that is let's try and get greater transparency about who owns the places we stay at, and then let's try and think about what they do with the proceeds of your stay and how those proceeds are invested. And all things being equal, local ownership in the country to which you travel is better than foreign extractive ownership. With, I should imagine, the following caveat, there are plenty of examples of local ownership which is radically extractive and highly exploitative and uses slave labor and is unsustainable. So it's local is better than foreign, but local is necessary but insufficient in terms of creating a more just outcome for dollars or pounds spent on X amount of travel.
Yeah, so we all know it's totally nuanced and it's totally, it totally depends on the human being. Yeah. So what's interesting though, I mean, I think we can't make so many broad statements, but we can tend to imagine that if an owner is from a destination, that they're going to be lean towards being a better custodian of that area. They're going to care more. They're probably more invested quite literally in the local community, employing locally. So there is going to be a correlation. If you start looking at the provenance or the origins of the money of most hotels, you do realize they tend to exist, certainly in the luxury sector, to make wealthy people richer. And you'll start realizing a lot of the hotels, you know, they are owned by big, big asset management portfolios. Or I just got asked about my two favourite hotels in Tasmania, Australia. One is owned by a casino company, another one by a professional gambler. I'm sure that's a Netflix series in the making, don't you think? And look, you know, it's complicated. It's arcane.
Okay, so if we broke it down a little, if you had the perfect ownership structure and the perfect resource allocation structure for the tourism industry, I'm going to throw a few things out there and then I'm sure you'll elaborate. So the first thing you would do is let's have it owned locally. Let's have a portion of the share ownership being done by local employees. Let's invest a portion of the proceeds into local communities. Let's have a supply chain of local social enterprises. And let's have the carbon footprint be thought about in a way that is as net zero and responsible as possible. And all of these things are kind of possible to do, right?
Yeah, it's utopian. You're describing to me, well, I'm hearing Fogo Island Inn in Canada as an example. I mean, that is always, for me, living example of a hotel that is transparent, so transparent that Zita Cobb, the creator, obviously created something called the Economic Nutrition Mark or certification label, where she shows you where your money goes. And you'll see how much of that stays right there on the island in Canada. You'll see that I think it's around 50% of all of their operating costs will go into labor. So that shows you that's the nutrition. That's the nutrition right there, is when the money's going, we're paying for human capital. It's this obsession, as we know, with real estate assets. That's the challenge. We're just talking about hotels. That's one aspect of why we travel. But you're exactly right. So if you have, it's when you consider stakeholders rather than just shareholders, because shareholders are very unrelated to many hotels. They're just not connected to that place. And I love that you mentioned that idea, you know, if there's a sense of ownership from the actual team, that does happen. We have that with some travel organizations. Sordes, based in Bristol, they also own Canopy and Stars. They have that model. It's a semi sort of charity and employee owned model. These are just new ways of doing business.
I guess another idea is that what you do is when you arrive in a destination, that's the beginning of your expenditure, but you can also go out on a local sightseeing visit or go and visit a local social enterprise or support a local charity or have a tour taken by a local women's cooperative. And so you think about the sort of secondary and ancillary expenditures that you do from the first place you arrive. And if you were to do that and sort of think about those secondary expenditures from a justice and from a sustainability perspective, you could leverage travel dollars or travel pounds in a more interesting way.
Paul, I'm so happy to hear you say this. I've never, ever in a conversation had people just so casually throw out, you know, the option to use social enterprises in your supply chain. You're absolutely right. And you'd be shocked at how few people consider that. That is something I certainly evangelize about. I can think of, an example in Cape Town, actually. You know, if you go to a cafe, there was one called, it has a really politically incorrect name. I loved it. It's a little cafe in Cape Town. It's called, I can't even say it. It's like Brownies and Downies or something, but it's run by people with Down syndrome. And if you're going to the, but that's the name of the cafe, right? That's my godson has Down syndrome, so I'm particularly excited to support businesses that are, you know, are showcasing that and giving people a chance to work in hospitality. And somewhere, you know, Delhi, lots of tour operators such as Intrepid or G Adventures will build this in, but your independent traveller won't necessarily think to do that. The cooperative, the stop-off. So Delhi, I love going to, you could go out to Agra. There's somewhere called Shiro's Hangout, which is a cafe which shines a light on women who are survivors of acid attacks, and you chat with them. It's pretty uncomfortable when you first walk in there because their faces really are incredibly disfigured. But as you spend time with them, I have to tell you, you know, I had a sunset and a sunrise picture at the Taj Mahal. I barely remember that. It's sitting and talking with these women. Honestly, I've got hairs on end remembering it. It's these really meaningful connections on our travels that are so powerful. I went on a tour with a former street kid in Delhi, again, supporting children in a charity going into education. So you're right to flag that. People don't always think of that.
I'm going to open up a parenthesis and have a mid-show show note, and that is, at the end of this podcast, we're going to give you a link to be able to look at all the places that you would recommend, because there's so many of those that I think people would be fascinated by, and they are the good forms of travel and the good forms of hospitality. And I wanted us to use the power of the voice to be able to draw attention to them. Close parentheses. So I want to come back to the travel question, because I think there is something irreducible about the trade-off between getting on an airplane, and until we get green aviation fuel, we are going to be in a world where we have, the further we travel, the worse our carbon footprints. And notwithstanding all the many virtues of travel, opening our minds, changing our politics, expanding our view of diversity, enriching our sense of culture, you could wax lyrical about that. And I believe in all of those things. I think those are genuine virtues. We're also setting those against a climate emergency and planetary boundaries. So where do you come out? Should we just make a pledge to travel less and staycation and localize? Or should we be burning through that carbon but doing good when we get to where we get?
Yeah, you know, it's just, the simple fact of the matter is aviation, your carbon footprint from flying will be the greatest contributor to your own personal carbon footprint. There is no getting away from that, right? As a sector, it's only 2.5% to 3%. But as an individual, I mean, you know, one return flight, even short haul, is going to be more kilograms of carbon than perhaps an individual in a less well-off country will produce in a year of their entire existence. So, you know, we can't get away from that. I think about it all the time, plays on my mind all the time. Offsetting, as we know, is close to being a nonsense. However, it's better than we we do it than nothing, but it's a distraction. I really do think about this a lot. I think that it's really, really important that we travel, as you said, for the reasons that Mark Twain echoes. You know, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness for those reasons. But we have to think about how do we decarbonize our trips. So me personally, yes, we have to fly less. I try and switch out my short-haul journeys by train. I've just done it in the last year. You know, I had to go to Slovenia for work. I took the train back. It was really enjoyable. Not going to lie, much more expensive. I came back through Austria, Germany, and France. I've just been to Lisbon. I went by train via Paris and Madrid. My carbon footprint from that, well, it would have been, I think it would have been 230 kilograms of carbon to fly. It was 85, that's 7% of that to take the train. So we can see that's a massive reduction. If you're going to set yourself a carbon budget, you need to fly less. And I think if we're responsible, we have to do that. Do I think bigger picture, because it, as we all know, it's all about the bigger picture. Do I think, you know, we can justify it? Well, we have to work hard to, but absolutely we can. Do I think high net worth people scooting around the world in their jets to St. Bart's here and St. Moritz there? That's not good. That's not helping. Is there wealth distribution happening as a result of that? To a degree, going back to our first conversation point, depends on where they're staying and who owns it. We just have to stop, think, how am I going to have a positive impact from every single link in my itinerary? How can I be responsible and do good? How can I support conservation? Because don't forget, a huge percentage of revenue for conservation globally comes from tourism projects. I mean, there's just that is absolutely where, you know, Africa, as we know, the continent is absolutely devastated through the loss of tourism in the last couple of years and needs that money and needs those tourists. So, you know, it just requires a bit of homework and thinking. I don't mean to sound glib and like a mum. It's fun, but it actually is fun trying to, you know, plan a trip that does good. And there are plenty of people wising up to it now and helping you do that.
So I'm going to latch on to something you said about offsets, because in some ways, you know, you expend excess carbon and then you salve your conscience by buying an offset. Now, if you didn't expend that carbon and you spent the money on the offset, then we would get to net zero quicker. But expending the carbon and buying the offset just stabilizes the problem at an unacceptable level of emergency. So I wonder if there's a way, and whether there are examples, or maybe this is just sort of ideating in our conversation, of thinking about the pounds and the dollars you spend on travel leading not to a zero offset, but actually to a net significant reduction in carbon, so that you price it in a way which says, I'm not just going to buy X amount of trees that are equal to my carbon footprint, but I'm going to get 2 or 3x on the other side, and then do so in a way that's sustainable, so that we're improving the situation by traveling in a way that those pounds or dollars would not be spent otherwise. So you kind of gear the economics in that way. And obviously the problem with that is you make it significantly more expensive, and then you have a problem that the virtuous are penalized. And then maybe we have to go back into a world of much more aggressive regulation. But talk me through some of those
questions. Each aspect of that is an entire podcast and conversation in itself, right? I mean, it really genuinely is. And I feel very strongly about some of those aspects that you've raised. What we're talking about is, well, anything that's elective and anything to do with flying is a very complicated conversation, because the aviation industry simply wouldn't survive if it wasn't subsidized. If we started mandating the kind of restrictions that I believe we should have, it just wouldn't exist. It wouldn't be able to function. I mean, we know, obviously, that kerosene or aviation fuel is the only fuel that's not taxed. Hasn't been since World War II. I just think we need to reduce our emissions. I think the very beginning of what you said is exactly that. People think by offsetting, which is just a nonsense, really, because you're not offsetting. You're just paying something good, you're still doing bad. They need to reduce. So a trick I would say is really, you do have to look at your flying, who you're flying with. Yeah, I just went to Costa Rica and I chose to great expense, fly direct. rather than going via Miami, which would have been half the price. I'm in the 0.2% who would choose to do that just because I can't carry the guilt. You know, I do support every single offsetting scheme that's added on to something because I want to demonstrate I care. I feel like I'm giving them market research that tells them to be a better business. You could break that down to what offsetting systems are you supporting? I mean, that's the main thing. I personally fund Tree Sisters. It doesn't even come down to carbon credits. I mean, everything's become so transactional and, you know, as we know, it's all metrics, but which invests in women planting specific trees in specifically parts of the world that does good, that empowers the women so they have the socioeconomic uplift to perhaps, you know, send their children to school and things like that. One thing I will just say, it's interesting. I just heard Microsoft. Did you hear about Microsoft with their team? They said to them, you're not allowed to fly as much business travel. So if you go over a certain amount, you have to voluntarily, you have to give a certain amount of money back to a very advanced level offsetting system. And I think that's what we have to have, is these cultures of there being a capped amount of travel. And above that, you have to pay more.
I heard a similar scheme for a couple of consulting companies, which now say every time you travel for business, you have to stay for 3 days. And what that's done from a kind of behavioral economics point of view is make people travel less because people wouldn't be inclined to go, well, I'm in and out. I'm in London. I can go to Berlin and I can come back the same day and that's fine.
Behavioral
change.
Say
3 days, yeah. All of a sudden you go, wow, 3 days, I'm away from my family. It's a bit of a pain. Maybe I'll just take a Zoom. So small little ways of changing the way people understand both behavior and incentives can make a massive difference.
You're exactly right. We need to spark systemic change. We need to inspire behavioral change. We need to wipe out that reflex, I'll just hop on a plane there and back. That's what we need to change.
I want to ask you a question about luxury wealth privilege, the 0.1%, and first class travel in 6-star hotels, and ask the following question. To the extent that we're not going to stamp this out, to the extent that we live in a world in which we think that it is acceptable to be able to do all of those things, and I think it's going to take a rather radical form of re-engineering our world for that not to persist, then are we in the world of saying this level of expenditure needs to be, because people have got so much wealth, there's been such a division of wealth and power in the world over the last couple decades, that we need to leverage this form of ultra-consumptive luxury experience in a way that is doubly good. So we try and create regulatory regimes which put more resource into sustainability, more resource into ethical payment systems and fair wages from that sector because it's got bigger margins to do. It's not to say it shouldn't apply across the board, but there seems to be some ability to extract more there. And then the trick is to make it more transformative, because if you can do it up top, it may in fact have a kind of ripple effect because it's symbolically or culturally more powerful than mass tourism at a Holiday Inn.
I think about this a lot. You're right. You mean the super tax. It makes sense. I do still think it comes down not just to regulation. I think it comes down to education. And I think the more that we invest in sort of making it terribly uncool to be reckless when it comes to the environment and nature and each other as human beings, and speak to the next generation globally, I do think that's, in the long run, I do think that's going to be more effective. So I'm thinking about these high net worth people that you're talking about. Now think of their kids. If we make it socially unacceptable and vulgar to be what was, you know, this sort of jet setting lifestyle, that's going to be really effective. If they're going to want to brag that they're, at the moment, you know, designer labels, we've seen a big turnaround on whether it's cool to have huge designer labels. We've seen things change in our society. And I think that different cultures are changing faster in different ways that we can't predict, actually. And I think a lot of these really high-end hotels, naturally, their storytelling, their experiences, engage the younger generation with nature and sort of subliminally, more subtly, inspire them to care more about nature. Honestly, I think it's the marine biologist taking your, you know, oil baron's kids out for a swim that might make them care more than necessarily the short-term legislation change. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Actually, I'm more in the camp not of prohibiting or making things socially unacceptable. I am more in the camp of changing the economics. By that I mean, if you can spend £500 for a pair of Gucci sneakers, you can pay £600. If you can stay in an Amman for £2,000, you can spend £2,500. Round numbers. So my hypothesis, and stay with me through this and tell me if you agree, is there are certain forms of expenditure that only the disproportionately wealthy 0.1% can undertake. That group can undertake those expenditures tenfold, a hundredfold more than the actual price. They're totally price insensitive. So you could imagine a regime which says that there is a sort of luxury tax which is allocated towards sustainability that would scoop up non-trivial amounts of money. It doesn't systemically change our system. But if you said every time you pay £500 for a pair of Gucci sneakers, £100 on top goes to a sustainable materials fund administered by a global nonprofit that is working on new forms of bioplastics and new forms of sustainable hemp, which will then go back into revolutionizing the supply chain and fashion. Or every time you spend more than £2,000 in a hotel, there's a £500 surcharge which goes into a fund which says, how do you green the hotels? How do you support an ecosystem of social enterprises which then are in the supply chain to them? Again, it's not going to be radically transformative, but it may allocate non-trivial amounts of money to sustainability and justice, the things we care about.
So you have just highlighted why I personally really do exist, which is particularly to navigate and influence high net worth travelers to the right hotels. It's not trivial amounts of money. It's significant. And actually, I've never had the opportunity to say this in this way, but, you know, I personally spotlight those hotels that you're suggesting through my list, which is Boutico. I have a list called Boutico Loves. It's non-profit. You can have a look at that. It's completely independent because there are hotels on there, such as the Brando in French Polynesia, where the percentage of your stay, unwittingly or wittingly, is going towards their R&D. They develop something called SWAC, which is a seawater air cooling system. They completely, you know, invented it, where actually it sounds quite simple. Then why isn't everyone doing it? A pipe goes down to the deep ocean, extracts the cold air from there. It's used to cool the rooms. It's powered by, I think, coconut oil. And they have used that system in other hotels in French Polynesia. There are lots of different of these hotels doing this R&D, funded by us. Well, certainly I'm not a high net worth traveler, but certainly the people staying in these hotels. So, and lots of them, I've just been to a Six Senses. They have a sustainability fund, so a percentage of your stay goes towards that. So you're exactly right. But many hotels, and certainly we know in Kenya, South Africa, Namibia, Botswana, a lot of these hotels are taking fairly significant chunks of money towards their conservation. So if you are just, all I'm asking is people are a little bit more judicious in where they stay. So if you look at the long run, it's a membership organization. All of their properties, or almost all of them, will have these kinds of initiatives. So I was speaking to someone the other day in Brazil, where they have this wonderful little hotel on a huge sprawler reserve in rainforest, and where they're actually, they've developed a new strain of grass. And that grass is so nutritious and rich and sequestering of carbon, actually, also, that the cattle that grazes on it only needs 25% of the amount of grass to eat, that sort of thing. So we're looking at big bring down of reduction in methane emissions. So imagine that. If you're choosing between two different properties, one, which is innovating and creating incredible solutions to world challenges, or another, which is really just a money-making business to make a rich person richer.
Okay, so what we clearly need then is disclosure, transparency, more lists like what you produce at Boutico, and then we probably need some kind of classification for sustainable hospitality and tourism, where you've got to check a whole bunch of different criteria in order to qualify. So it's not just arbitrary and greenwashing. There are some objective criteria you need to meet. Now, I'm sure there are either existing or nascent standards in the industry? I mean, are they uniformly applied?
There isn't a universal standardized, let's call it accreditation, because they're all paid for. They're for-profit businesses. There is the GSTC, the Global Sustainable Tourism Council's framework, which is probably the best respected. It originated, you know, through the United Nations. But how do we know someone's actually adhering to it? I always use a very crass analogy of you know, you can give someone the Bible, but it doesn't say they're following the Ten Commandments. So there are many, but as I say, they are commercial. I do respect EarthCheck. Their platinum certification, the highest level, certainly means someone's gone through a very rigorous assessment. I love B Corp certification. There are not that many hotels because it doesn't transfer that easily. It's better for travel operators. We have Greenview. I mean, look, they count about 800 certifications just in the tourism sector. I think we need to be a little bit more literate ourselves. And look, think of these small, independently run guest houses. They might not have fancy green energy systems, but going back to that idea of community economics, your money's still going to the right place. I'm going to, full disclosure here, I'm not entirely independent when I say this. I'm really proud to be working with a team that's developing a piece of tech, actually. It's called Weaver. And it will be a platform for hotels to plug into that they will be able to put in their data, because that's what we need is hard data. We need a live impact score that will tell you their impact. And that is actually based on the Long Run's 4Cs framework. So it looks at conservation, community, culture, and your favorite, commerce, because we need businesses to be good, profitable businesses. The charity model doesn't work.
Another mid-show show note, we're going to try and refer to a couple of those certification schemes, certainly not all 800 of them, but I'm very keen that listeners begin to get a sense of what are good certification schemes that they can look out for.
I think with any accreditation, what you have to look at when it comes to sustainability, is it coming out of their marketing budget, or are they genuinely investing operations in being a more sustainable business? So EarthCheck or an accreditation like that is actually looking at their operations, measuring and setting targets and bringing down use of utilities and consumption. And so that's meaningful. I think a lot of these little badges, if they just help them look nice and are an easy shortcut, if you start to dig a bit deeper, if there isn't quite an aggressive third party system of measuring it, then what does it really mean?
Incredibly rich conversation. I want to leave people with your top three tips. If you're just saying, if you're about to travel and if you're about to go on an adventure and stay somewhere elsewhere, what are the top three things that you should think of if you're trying to be a more conscious tourist?
So absolutely, we want to inspire and uplift. And traveling, you know, they say, I think neuroscientists say that the biggest hit you get is in the planning. It's the anticipation of a trip. And so, you know, I think take joy in looking at who you're giving your money to. Who can you invest in? So whether it's a travel operator who looks like they really choose all, we say suppliers, that's such a functional word, but chooses all their hotels and their experts and their guides who are going to give you the best experience. Because it's about fun. A trip has to be about fun. I really covered it as well. We talked about it. Is ownership. I think that that's not discussed nearly enough in the travel conversation. Look at who you're staying with. Follow the money. That's what we know. I would say number two, again, just to emphasize, we need to decarbonize every aspect of our existence the moment we step out of home, when we are at home. And if we can travel slower and we can take trains, or we can, even better, we can get about by bike, take public transport. I think the pandemic put us off public transport for a while. I just took the metro a couple of weeks ago from across Paris. It was 8 a.m. I had a 22-kilo suitcase. For a moment, I was regretful. But then, you know what? Just sitting on, I went on three different trains. I looked at the different people. I looked at the posters. It gave me a really rich experience of Paris that I wouldn't have had otherwise. I went to Bastille. I looked out the window. I looked at the canal. It just, I felt like a local. I was only there for a morning transiting through. So it's really just bring that down. And of course, we know a big part of decarbonisation is our diets. So eat plant-heavier diets while we're on the move. Less animal products, less dairy. It's going to be hard in lots of parts of the world that has delicious cheese. Buy local, drink local wines, give them a go. I've heard that India's even, I spoke to someone at an Oman hotel the other day, they even serve some local Indian wines now. So really just bring down your carbon footprint. Bring down your carbon footprint in every way you can. And number three, well, let me think. How about just be more minimalist? You want maximalist experiences, devour culture, engage with everyone you meet along the way, but pack less, take less, buy less, consume less, waste less. Because we used to think of holidays and travel as a time of excess. You know, people would seduce you, buy a new summer wardrobe, get this. You do not need to do these things. It really is about the people you meet and the places you see, and that doesn't require any added accessories. And by the way, when you get on a plane, if you do get on a plane, imagine if everyone on that plane took less with them, less junk, right? That would require a lot less fuel to fly that plane.
Those are three incredibly helpful paragraph-length ideas, but I think they're capable of implementation, and this has been a very rich conversation. I encourage everybody to go look at the show notes because there's lots of nuggets that we will deposit there. And Juliet, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. It was a rich conversation.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. Please do subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. To learn more about Juliet and her work, please visit her website or follow her on Instagram. And for more information about The Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.